Around the world, more than 80 women have accused Peter Nygaard of crimes ranging from rape to sex trafficking.
He far exceeds Jeffrey Epstein. He far exceeds Bill Cosby. He exceeds anything that I think our world has seen so far.
A pattern of predatory behavior spanning half a century. Nygaard denies it all, but now he faces criminal charges.
If this were a poor man, he would have been in jail decades ago. He is hid in plain sight.
Evil by Design, available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Stephanie Skenderis, in for Brent Bambury. This is Day 6.
Haiti is descending into a deepening crisis.
I have 8 agencies failed Haiti.
We have little to show for all the amount of money that was spent in Haiti.
We can't shift that burden and say all of the blame lies on Haiti when we've played a role in precipitating this.
Why Western help isn't helping Haiti. That's coming up on Day 6. Today, the queen of my dreams.
The rules are meant to be broken.
Amrish Kaur stars in a queer, Bollywood-inspired coming-of-age story. From debutante to IRA bomb maker.
She was determined to show that she had rejected her background.
The extraordinary life of Rose Dugdale. And rap on trial.
Really painted a picture of a violent person.
The problem with treating lyrics as admissible evidence. All today on Day 6. The Can I Get a Witness edition.
I went out yesterday and there were dead bodies in the street.
Fighting and violence spread further into the suburbs around Haiti's capital this week. The country has been in a deepening crisis since last February, when heavily armed groups began attacking the government of Prime Minister Ariel Henry. Henry took over nearly 3 years ago, after the assassination of the country's president. He resigned last week, leaving a power vacuum, and calls for foreign aid and intervention to stabilize the country. But Jemima Pierre says the roots of today's crisis can be traced back to past foreign interventions.
Right now, this is just a flare-up of an ongoing situation that really began about 20 years ago.
Jemima Pierre is a Haitian-American anthropologist at the University of British Columbia. Jemima, good morning, and welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when you hear Western leaders, including Canadians, saying they want to help Haiti or send aid or support its institutions, what do you think?
I think it's them helping Haiti that's actually put us in this position that we're in right now. One of the things about the U.S., France, and Canada is that they're part of the major problem. They're part of what's happening in Haiti. And I say this, and I don't say this lightly, because Haiti has been beset by interventions and occupations from its founding. And for people who don't know, Haiti is the first and only successful slave revolt in the history of the modern world, where Africans were able to destroy the institution of slavery and defeated Napoleon's army, because Haiti was a French colony. And as a result of that history, what ended up happening was Haiti was put on an embargo by the Western countries, particularly the U.S., which did not recognize Haiti until 60 years after its independence. And so after that moment, what you've had is a number of military, economic, and political interventions, beginning with France demanding an indemnity payment from the formerly enslaved to pay the former slave owners. And Haiti had to pay that. It took them more than 100 years. They didn't finish paying it till 1947. It's worth about billions of dollars. And then the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, took Haiti's gold and rewrote Haiti's constitution. And then the U.S., France, and Canada, if you look up the Ottawa Initiative, where they decided Aristide, the Haiti's first popularly elected president and democratically elected president, they did not want him and his policies. He was not installing the neoliberal policies that they wanted. And so they decided that they would remove him from power. And by 2004, they did so. The U.S. Marines landed, took Aristide, put him on a plane, and sent him to Africa. At the same time, you had French, U.S., and Canadian troops on the ground in Haiti. And from that moment in 2004, what you have then is the complete systematic destruction of the Haitian state.
I want to bring us up to 2010 and the earthquake that happened then. Obviously, you know, large parts of Haiti were devastated. The world was moved and watching what had happened and I think wanted to help. But what was the result of that outside aid?
There were about $13 billion that were raised, and the majority of it went not to Haitians, but back to Washington, D.C., because it was given out in terms of contracts and payoffs and so on and so forth. In fact, there's a whole story about the Red Cross raising almost $1 billion and building 6 houses. It was a free-for-all for the Western corporations, for the international NGOs, and for everyone except Haiti. And I have to remind you that the U.S. had this policy from 2000 with Aristide of funneling aid, not to the Haitian government directly, but through international organizations. Because with the coup d'etat in 2004, the U.N. Security Council actually consecrating that coup d'etat with a so-called peacekeeping mission that was sent there and with a group called the Core Group, the U.S., France, Canada, the European Union, and Brazil, that basically started making decisions for Haiti. So you have this U.N. so-called peacekeeping mission, which ends up being an occupation that goes from 2004 to 2017, led militarily by Brazil, but led politically by the Core Group, which in 2010 brought cholera to Haiti, and that killed 10 to 30,000, sickened 1 million, and also resulted in tons of violence, including murders and so on. The UN, by the way, has never compensated Haiti for the cholera that killed people in the country, nor fixed the infrastructure, because the cholera came because the UN base was dumping feces in the local water in the main region, the Artibonite region of Haiti. It's while we have cholera, while we have, right after the earthquake, where you have 1.5 million people who are not even housed, right, because they lost their homes, 220,000 people die. And I think that's important to think about 2010, because that really establishes the case for where we are today in terms of like the call for another armed intervention, because what intervention has meant for Haiti has been death, misery, destruction, and constant undermining of people's sovereignty and dignity.
I think when you look at Haiti and what's happening right now, it's often portrayed as this chaotic power vacuum that's being filled by these armed violent groups. How do you see it?
When I see Haiti right now, I think the Western media coverage of Haiti has been horrendous and racist. It's painful as a Haitian person to watch. But then I remember there's a New York Times article in 1921 with the headline, "Haitians eat a U.S. Marine," right? And so part of that is to think about like the nonstop representation of Haitians since the revolution of like these savages, of these cannibals. And so you present them as savages. And so then you create the narrative for everyone to say, well, it's okay. These savages need to put down. We need to send a robust force, right? And so the imagery is really terrible. The idea of gangs, I don't use the term gangs. I use armed groups because I think it's a very racialized term. These are paramilitary groups. A lot of them are former police and former militaries. This political party that the U.S. was behind putting into place, the PHTK party, which began with Michel Martelly, actually created these large groups of armed people. They would use these groups to attack, to take out rivals. Michel Martelly and even Ariel Henry, the unelected prime minister that the U.S. installed in 2021, the U.S. and the Core Group, what they would do is when people were protesting economic policies, so in 2020, 2019, 2018, asking for economic relief, he sends armed groups to shoot into the crowds. Michel Martelly did the same thing.
Well, what do you think is the answer then? Is it that there's no foreign intervention at all, or is there a different kind of outside help that would be better? What do you think the answer is?
Well, you know, the Haitians, you know, the civil society came together in 2021, right before and after the assassination. There was two major groups that came up with their own transition plan, and the U.S. completely did not pay attention to any of these groups. People from all sectors of society came together and had a plan, and the U.S. insisted on, you know, militarily upholding this illegitimate government. And right now, what the U.S. is doing is also looking bad, right? Because they brought together a group in Jamaica to determine a 7-member council. They met secretly before they let in the Haitians. And then in the negotiations, they only allowed Haitian groups that said that the first thing that they would agree to is a foreign intervention into Haiti. But we don't know under what laws they're acting. We don't know how long it's going to be. And people are saying that, well, how is it that the U.S. gets to decide what the political solution is when we've been saying it all along and they haven't listened? So I think what the U.S. needs to do is to step back and allow other people to come in. Like, so for example, the president of Honduras, they're trying to come up with a group along with St. Vincent Grenada in Colombia to come up with a different solution where they bring in Haitian people to talk to each other and ask them what kind of help that they want. And so if the U.S. would drop its insistence, it actually let Haitians take control. There are people ready to step up because Haitians, remember, won independence on their own in 1804. And without outside interference, we would be so much better off than we are today.
Jemima, thank you so much for speaking with us about this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jemima Pierre is a Haitian-American academic and anthropologist at UBC.
Little details that we often miss, you know, about the trash is not being collected. The water pump is not working. You know, there is no fuel. The hospital has no power. These basic things or most mundane things now in Gaza are very heroic acts every day.
Hani Al-Madhoun is a Palestinian-American who works for UNRWA. His family lives in Beit Lahia at the northernmost tip of Gaza. A UN-backed report released this week says malnutrition and food insecurity are rampant in northern Gaza and that famine is imminent and likely to occur there by May. Hani Al-Madhoun says the Israeli military has mostly cleared out of the area now, but aid still isn't getting in reliably. So Hani's brother, Mahmoud, has started up a soup kitchen to feed whoever he can with whatever he can find.
People use food as a weapon now in Gaza, unfortunately. Let's think about, so there is no chicken in northern Gaza right now. They've eaten all the pasta for the last 4 months. There is no pasta left in Gaza. And rice and flour are not coming by. So what they've been eating is, you know, they grinded some rabbit food and things like that to survive. And the six items that are available in the north right now is basically cooking oil, margarine, tomato paste, ketchup, some za'atar spice, which is a dip, and that's just about it. My own father has a shortage of calcium, and my mom tells me he walks and falls every few steps. You can imagine, you know, how worried I am about them. Not only that they had to bury their kids and their grandkids, they've lost their homes, and now they're starved. We decided to try to do something about it, and I've been fortunate enough to have a local community-led response to make sure that our families like ours get to eat. Maybe 2 months ago, I've had some money from friends who said they want to get some food to people. So I called up my brother Mahmoud and I said, hey Mahmoud, can you help people figure out how to get some rice? He said, yeah. So the first day he got some 100 portion of rice and gave it away. The next day he went to the place. The place was out of business. They said, sorry, we don't have any rice in the market. So we said, what can we do? Then Mahmoud said, hey, how about if I figure out a way to cook for people? And I said, great. So he started with soup. The pickers went and they got zucchinis that are the size of pumpkins. These zucchinis meant to be really small, but they, because nobody dared to go pick them, they became so big. So my brother will chop them up, add some tomato paste and some seasoning, and then people show up. He did that the first day, 120 families showed up. He said, good, that's it. He went home. The next day, people showed up at his house asking for food. They thought this is something that's going to happen every day. There is challenges we're dealing with to make that happen. Communication, obviously, the army have taken out all these towers. That's the first challenge. The second one, how do we get the money? There's no banks, Western Union, ATMs, that's it. They're cut off the world. Then, you know, how he's going to find these logistical things. And he's been resourceful and he tried to do this. Mahmoud is a changed man. He was detained. You know, you've seen these images of the unclothed Palestinian men. He was one of them. And you can see him in the video that's in December. And that experience really changed him because he thought he's never going to live again. So he's finding purpose in cooking for people, and just he is able to provide food. Now they're serving up to 450 families a day. But it shouldn't be on a civilian like my brother to solve an international crisis created by civilized nations. They know about this starvation. My family loves that it became a center of attention for a lot of the people in the community. It helped them provide a healthy distraction from the grieving and the destruction they're still unpacking and dealing with. We've lost a lot of good people from our family, and I hope not many more families deal with losses like we did and our neighbors are doing right now.
Hani Al-Madhoun is a Palestinian-American who works for UNRWA. His family lives in Beit Lahia at the northernmost tip of Gaza. Still to come on day 6, heiress, rebel, vigilante, bomber. The extraordinary life of Rose Dugdale. I'm Stephanie Skenderis, in for Brent Bambury.
I know we just met, but would you be willing to lift your shirt up and show me your torso?
That is Amrit Kaur, playing Bella in Mindy Kaling's show, The Sex Lives of College Girls. It was a breakout role for her, and one that has earned her a lot of praise. And now, Amrit Kaur has stepped into her first leading film role in The Queen of My Dreams. Well, actually, it's two roles. The Queen of My Dreams is a coming-of-age story of both a mother and her daughter. Amrit plays Azra, a young queer Muslim living in Toronto.
The rules are meant to be broken.
Okay.
I don't care what people think.
She also plays a young version of Azra's mother, living in Karachi, Pakistan in the late 1960s.
I've always wanted to go to California.
I'm going to the West.
Achala.
Canada.
Are you joking?
The movie explores the characters' complicated relationships to their countries and to each other. It's also funny and stylish. It weaves in Bollywood influences, and Amrit Kaur is up for a Canadian Screen Award for performance in a leading role. Amrit, welcome to day 6.
Thank you.
You take on these two different roles in The Queen of My Dreams. Can you tell me a little more about these two women that you play that are so different from one another?
Yeah, I mean, they're also so similar, which I think is the metaphor, the purpose of having them both be played by the same actor is the message of the mirroring between daughter and mother. And that, you know, even though we don't want to be like our parents, we are.
I've read that you've talked about being intimidated by this project before you started filming. What scared you about it?
You know, I was coming from Sex Lives of College Girls, which is a comedy, and going into, you know, even though it is a dramedy, the initial script was very drama leading and heavy in the vulnerability. So I was scared of all of that. There was so much life work that I had to catch up on, really looking at my relationship with my mother, how I've treated her, how I've abused her, how I've hated her and loved her and all of those things. And I went to Italy to do a 5-week masterclass with my coach, Michelle Lonsdale-Smith. I was petrified, did some of the worst behavior I've had as a student, walked out of class. You know, I've never done that because I have a phenomenal coach who was holding me accountable to look at what I didn't want to look at.
Yeah, where was that coming from? Is it like the exploration of these things that are kind of uncomfortable?
I think it's more this desperate desire to be perfect. Hmm. And we live in a society, we live in such a woke culture, which is like anything where I'm flawed is cancelable. And that mixed with upbringing and realities of my life, I didn't want to be a flawed person, which was what the script was asking me to reveal. And flawed in the way I treat my mother, flawed in my disdain for my homeland, flawed in the coming out journey, flawed in so many ways. And I've just grown up trying to be a perfect good girl, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I had difficulty looking at my sins.
But this film and this script seems to demand vulnerability and exploring these things. And it must be really personal for you and also for Fawzia Mirza, who wrote and directed this film based on a stage play, her short film, and inspired, I think, by her own life, right? Growing up queer, South Asian, Muslim in Canada. What guidance did you get from her on diving into all of this?
It was extremely personal for her. It's based off of many real experiences for her. What I will say is that she held space for me to be scared. And there were scenes where I walk in to my mother crying because my father has died. I remember walking out and after every take being like, "Have I told your story, Fawzia? Are you being seen?" That was really important to me. So she held space for all of that. And I also was doing the movie with Hamza Haq, and he was also quite supportive and we both held each other accountable for telling the truth to the deepest we were capable of at that time.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a very special experience. And it's also, a lot of the movie is filmed actually in Pakistan. What was that experience like?
It's great. You know, I think that's one of the most revolutionary things about the film. Very few productions that the film location is in Pakistan are actually shot in Pakistan and Karachi in particular. So this is one of the few that are beginning to change that. And that was amazing. And of course, it was fun to wake up and everybody knowing what real chai is, not a chai latte from Starbucks, you know, like authentic chai. And little quirks like that is like, yeah, man, this is fantastic. And it's such a service-oriented culture. It's the thing that I love most about South Asia is being in service is part of our bones. That's part of our spirituality. So it's often different than in North America, where it's a job mm-hmm. to be in service. As Canadian, I feel like I've been taught that I have to rise up to fame and glory so that I don't serve and I am served. It's a different thing I've been taught here.
So did being around that make you reflect on that, you know, upbringing that I guess we have from growing up here of being in search of the fame and glory?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even doing the film, like a lot of people said to me, why would you do a Canadian film right out of Sex Lies? Why wouldn't you do an American film? And I thought about that a lot too. But then it's like, what? Being Canadian is second class? Do I actually believe that? No. I believe in the elevation of talent. I go towards talent. So going back to Pakistan, yes, there was so much I had to reflect on because I couldn't think about it intellectually anymore. I was viscerally there.
Hmm. The film is also investigating the country's history. It shows Pakistan in the late 60s being quite different from modern day Pakistan. What was it like to explore that moment in time?
I don't know that I can speak too much to that because I'm not from Pakistan, you know, so I want to respect that. But I will say that it was an absolute honor as an Indian person. Now, my grandparents are Pakistani, but at a time where there's so much hate between borders, that I had a Muslim filmmaker who's Pakistani being open to an Indian Sikh woman telling the story of Pakistan in the 60s. I'm very proud that I could help tell that story.
Mm-hmm. And it involved learning another language. It involved learning all these other elements, right? Was that difficult?
Oh, it was very difficult. I mean, it's hard. Like, I'm using difficult as a grain of salt. I mean, privilege, you know. But yeah, it's so my mother tongue is Punjabi, which is I guess you could compare it to Creole and French. Mm-hmm. Punjabi is a far more like staccato language. So it was a lot of work and I felt very excited to be able to train myself to learn another language.
One of the other big themes of The Queen of My Dreams is sexuality and romantic relationships. That's also very present, of course, in Sex Lives of College Girls. And your character in that show is very sex positive. Mm-hmm. Is there something about exploring that theme or representing that on screen that appeals to you?
Yes, absolutely. And it appeals to me because South Asians are humans. They have sex like everybody else. And so why don't we see it? Anything that's humanizing the South Asian experience appeals to me.
And now you're back to filming The Sex Lives of College Girls, right? Is there anything that you learned or did on The Queen of My Dreams that you're taking back with you?
I mean, I think my lifelong journey is to be in service to the character. And there's so many people who reach out and even on the street will tell me how moved they are seeing a South Asian woman that way, reflected in full sexuality, full confidence, full dominance. And really my goal is to go back and to be in service to all of those people who feel seen and inspired by Bella. And that's always my goal, and that's the goal again.
Amrit, it's been so great to chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was quite an insightful chat. I'm so happy we got to have it.
Amrit Kaur stars in the film The Queen of My Dreams. It's now screening in select theaters across Canada.
Women indicated to the men this, that, and the other picture which they were to tear off the walls.
In April of 1974, Sir Alfred Beit became the victim of what was then the world's largest art heist. Beit had an estate outside of Dublin, Ireland, and one night, a woman feigning a French accent knocked on the door, asking for help with her stalled car. She wasn't French. She was English. Her name was Rose Dugdale, and she was a member of the IRA. Three armed men who were with her forced their way into the house, pistol-whipped the elderly owners, and went on to steal 19 paintings, including Vermeer's Lady Writing a Letter with Her Maid. Rose Dugdale died on Monday in Dublin. She was 83. This weekend, a new film telling her story opens in Ireland. It's called Baltimore, and it stars Imogen Poots.
I hadn't heard of her before the project. And then, of course, you open this entire sort of archive, and there's so much information about Rose Dugdale. And she's one of those crucial figures that can often fall between the cracks historically.
Rose Dugdale grew up in an aristocratic family. In 1958, she was part of the last group of debutantes presented to Queen Elizabeth. She then went to Oxford, where she dressed as a man so she could be part of the debating team, thus becoming the first woman in the Oxford Debating Society. She became disillusioned with her wealthy background and became a Marxist, eventually giving away her $1 million in inheritance. She was also very angry. She moved to Ireland and joined the IRA. She made bombs for them. And she spent more than 6 years in prison for her role in the art heist and the hijacking of a helicopter. So the way people are remembering her is mixed. Some Sinn Féin members have called her a legend and a hero. Others call her a murderer. Sean O'Driscoll wrote her biography. Heiress, rebel, vigilante, bomber, the extraordinary life of Rose Dugdale was published in 2022. Sean, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you, Stephanie.
So you spent years trying to get access to Rose Dugdale. When you finally got to meet her and interview her, what was your first impression?
I remember the first interview. I was struck by how unrepentant an IRA woman she was and how she had stolen paintings from a rather fancy house in Ireland and had absolutely no remorse about it. And she, you know, she was involved in a situation where people over the age of 70 were beaten. But she kind of said, well, they made their fortune in South Africa during apartheid, which they did. And therefore, they're getting a little taste of what black people have experienced in apartheid South Africa. So I have no sympathy for them. And it's kind of, you know, for somebody at that advanced age in life, you kind of don't expect that kind of hardness. And that was my first impression. But then I think over time, I began to see that while she looks at the world rather rigidly politically, that she is quite a compassionate person to people that she feels are marginalized.
What is it about her that made you and others want to tell her story now?
I mean, it's kind of one of those stories that writes itself. You know, it just powers along because it's so extraordinary that a debutante who had been presented to the Queen in Buckingham Palace and had lived such an affluent life in London, huge big double townhouse in Chelsea and country estate, would end up in the IRA fighting alongside people who were really from the very poorest in Irish society, from West Belfast and the Bogside, these kind of ghetto urban ghettos. And it just immediately I wanted to know why and what she was really about, you know.
This is something that you just mentioned, but Rose grew up in a life of privilege, and that privilege allowed her to do things like go to university, where she earned a BA, an MA, a PhD. What do you think her thoughts were about growing up in this kind of privilege? Was it a tool that she could use? Did she kind of reject the idea of it completely?
Yeah, I mean, she did reject it completely. I mean, she was determined to kind of proved that too by giving away her entire fortune to the poor of London. And she set up an office in Tottenham, and if you had bills to pay or immigrant families, like really the poorest of London would come, and she would give them coal and clothes for children and all sorts of things. And she would pay for bail for all sorts of radical groups. And so she was determined to show that she had rejected her background.
But at one point she robbed her own family of art and jewelry. What did she do with the money from that?
She got caught. She had stored it at an Oxford professor's house. So she never actually got all the money for it. But the idea was that she would sell all this stuff to raise money for the IRA. And then there was this incredible courtroom drama between herself and her father that the newspapers just absolutely lapped up, where she was saying, you know, "Oh, Daddy, I love you, but there's this now gulf between us, and nothing, you know, nothing will end that except the death of one of us." And it was all so dramatic. And that kind of set her on a course then of, at that point, her sister Caroline, who was married to a Conservative MP, just gave up on her, and they never spoke again for the rest of their lives. But her brother James stayed in contact even after she was released from prison and so on. But it certainly burnt some family bridges.
Speaking of dramatic, that famous art heist is incredibly dramatic. At the time, it was the largest heist in the world. Millions of dollars of art by today's standard. She was working with the IRA at the time, but what was the reason for the heist? Because it was violent. Mm-hmm. So why did they do it?
Well, the idea was that they would keep these paintings and try and force the transfer of four IRA prisoners who were in London, that they would be sent back to prison in Belfast. And if their demands weren't met, that they would destroy the paintings. That was basically the idea, which is kind of an extraordinary position for somebody who was in finishing school and learnt about art in school, that she would threaten to do something like that.
She also became involved with making bombs for the IRA. And as with a lot of the violence during the Troubles, innocent people were killed. When you met with her, did she ever express remorse for the violence she helped bring about?
No, not at all. No, people get kind of annoyed when I say that, but like, I'm, you know, not responsible. But she, because there's now peace in Northern Ireland, she and others around her would say that they had brought the position to the negotiating table and then handed it over to the IRA's political wing, Sinn Féin, which is now the largest political party both in Northern Ireland and in the Republic of Ireland. So that's an incredible achievement for the party, but Rose and her partner Jim, I feel, have kind of created a structure around it where they basically say, well, you know, we had to force these issues and bring them onto the table for a final peace negotiation.
If you look at headlines or social media, reaction to her is quite divided. Some people remember her as a hero. Others say she was nothing more than a murderer. How do you view the life of Rose Dugdale?
I guess in the book, I tried to stay as neutral as I could. And when I reflect back, I see both sides. I mean, she did save a lot of lives in London. I mean, she, you know, kind of the middle class volunteers who came to our office were completely shocked by the poverty that they didn't know existed in London at the time. Families that were literally breaking up their own furniture to burn to stay warm for the winter, and children who didn't even have an overcoat. And then, you know, in Dublin, she took on drug dealers through Concerned Parents Against Drugs, which was a vigilante group. And everybody I spoke to from that time remembers her absolute fearlessness. Like, she walked up to the most dangerous drug dealers in the whole of Ireland, heroin dealers, and told them that she would shoot them if they didn't leave. And she occupied their houses, and, you know, she was beaten by the police for doing that. And so that's one side. But then the other side is that she was very, very heavily involved in weapon development for the IRA. Weapons that really did kill a lot of people. Like, you had shoulder-held missiles that were fired at police vans that blew up the police vans, killed people. And then Rose personally was involved in developing a new type of fuse that was used in massive IRA bombs in London. That system was used in Canary Wharf bombing in mid-90s London that caused over £1 billion worth of damage in the center of the financial district in London. So I see somebody who was, on a personal level, very, very compassionate to people who were marginalized. And same in prison as well. The prisoners also said the same thing. She just, there was nothing she wouldn't do for prisoners when she was in prison. But on the other side, I see such brutality, you know. But I mean, as the IRA's political wing is now the largest party in Ireland, the whole framework to how that is now viewed has changed, I think. You know, when I was growing up, it was just a daily horror show. And now it's kind of seen as kind of a part of the Republican movement's political development, of which Rose Dugdale was part.
Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Stephanie.
Sean O'Driscoll is the author of RS, Rebel, Vigilante, Bomber, The Extraordinary Life of Rose Dugdale. Rose Dugdale died in Dublin on Monday. She was 83. Still to come on Day 6, Rift from the Headlines, our weekly musical news quiz, and your chance to win a Day 6 tote bag.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, host of Wiretap. Each week you're invited to listen in on my telephone conversations, whether funny, sad, wistful, or even slightly strange. You never know just what you might hear on Wiretap.
I mean, I knew you had a show. I just didn't think that people actually listen to it.
Howard,
that's the breadth of your genius, Jonathan. It's not just that you're funny, but you can be cripplingly, poignantly depressing.
The Wiretap Archives, available on CBC Listen, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Stephanie Skenderis, in for Brent Bambury. You're listening to Day 6 from CBC Radio. We're on public radio stations across the United States. You can listen on demand with the CBC Listen app. We're available wherever you get your podcasts and at cbc.ca/day6.
A judge in the Young Thug trial has ruled prosecutors can use the rapper's lyrics as evidence.
Atlanta rapper Young Thug is on trial in a sprawling anti-racketeering case. And the prosecution is using his lyrics as evidence against him. It's the most high-profile case where that has happened. But it's not the only one. And now a new documentary called As We Speak, Rap Music on Trial, looks at what happens when rap lyrics are treated as admissible evidence.
The criminalization of hip-hop is not new, it's an old tactic.
When I'm storytelling in a song, you gonna use that against me?
Every song, every lyric, every video that you've ever been involved with, they're going to use against you.
The film follows Bronx-raised rapper Kemba. And through conversations with artists, scholars, and legal experts, it looks at how the legal system can turn art into evidence and songwriting into a criminal conviction. Kemba and the film's director, J.M. Harper, are with us. Good morning to you both. Welcome to Day 6.
Of course.
Yeah, thank you, Stephanie.
Let's just get into it, guys. I loved watching this doc. Kemba, how did it feel to learn that your lyrics could be taken seriously as evidence in a court of law?
It was super concerning, the idea that our words can be sort of twisted and turned and used in someone else's sort of agenda. And there's not much that we could do about it, or just the idea of even going in depth with it and seeing that there was a whole system in place against one person, you know, like a a judge that does it 100 times a day and a prosecutor that's so used to this, all of the weight of the system against one person is really kind of scary.
Yeah, I bet. And JM, the scholars and legal experts that you spoke to in the doc, they said that putting rap lyrics on trial isn't actually new. What is the history that's at work there?
Right. So the strategy of using lyrics against defendants in trials has been in practice for at least the last three decades, almost since the inception of hip-hop as a genre. What the documentary explores is both that as well as the precedent that was set for centuries leading up to that. And it traces the origin story of Black lyrics and Black song making and the ways that it has been in conflict with state power, really from the first moments that Africans entered onto the shores of the Americas. And it tells the stories of rebellion through song as early as the Stono Rebellion that happened in the 16, 1700s. So yeah, the answer to the question of how long has this been going on, it just depends on how deep down the rabbit hole you want to go. And the doc seeks to explore it from the origin and not just in the last 30 years that it's been used so effectively in court.
And one of the more recent pieces of research that you used that I found so interesting, it was the work of a researcher named Adam Dunbar about an experiment that he did involving lyrics from a few different genres. Can you tell me about that research?
Yeah. So Adam Dunbar did a comparison between three genres of music. So he took the same lyric, just so happened to be like a country western song from the 60s, from 1960. And he took that same lyric, but he told three different groups of people in an experiment that the lyrics came from three different genres to see how people would react to the lyrics if they thought that it came from heavy metal or hip hop or country music. So making that empirical study, the result was that when people listened to the same lyrics, but when they perceived it to be heavy metal or country music, they didn't have the same reaction as when they thought that they were rap lyrics. So the test group that thought that they were reading rap lyrics, when they were asked questions afterwards, they responded saying that they believed that whoever the songwriter was had more proclivities to violence, that they actually intended to do the things that the lyrics said. And these were kind of astonishing findings that revealed, even when race wasn't brought into the equation, just the genre of rap music was enough to sort of taint a person's perspective on whoever it was behind the lyrics. And the studies have shown that people have a tendency to view rap music, people who make rap music, as more violent, as more prone to do the things explicitly that are said in the music, as opposed to seeing it just as an act of expression.
Yeah. Kemba, one of the people that you spoke to in the documentary was Mac Phipps, and he spent more than 20 years in prison for manslaughter, even though somebody else confessed to the crime. He's now been released, but what did he tell you about how his lyrics were presented in court?
He told me, well, first off, it wasn't a one-to-one connection. Like a lot of people, when they hear about this thing, they don't really understand the fight against it, because they think it's a one-to-one connection. Like if a shooting happened on 45th Street and somebody rapped, "I shot somebody on 45th Street," then it wouldn't make much sense for us to be here trying to advocate against using it. But like in Mac Phipps' case, they took a line from one song and a line from another song and really painted a picture of a violent person for a jury. So it really was just sort of painting a person to look violent, even though, you know, they didn't have any physical evidence and somebody actually confessed.
You also spoke to experts who share how, you know, today social media has opened up all these new ways for artists to be surveilled online. Kemba, did learning about this make you think differently about what you say or share online if you know that it's being watched to see if any of it can also be brought into court?
In the film, I talked about going to high school every day and passing these mobile police stops during the height of the stop and frisk era. And it's like everyone knows the danger that goes along with stepping outside in that era, and all the elders, my mom telling me be safe and all that stuff, but you don't expect it to happen. You can't predict being harassed by the police, and you can't predict your art being used and twisted against you in this way. And so it's really hard to plan for it. And then you also don't want to censor yourself in your art. You want to have a true sort of expression. And so I really don't know the solution for what an artist could do to sort of prevent this from happening that doesn't take away from the expression of your own art form, you know? And so for me, it's more important to try to stop it in its tracks.
Ken, but just going back to what you were saying at the end there, that really gets to part of the really nuanced conversation, I think, around this, because rap is art, clearly, but it's also often based on lived experiences. Do you worry that in trying to stop people from assuming that every lyric is a literal truth, that you end up making it seem like they don't have any basis in reality?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of the reason why I try to be very specific with the explanation of this. Because you don't want to say, like, our words don't have any power, or that people aren't creating representations of their own experiences. But I think that's the importance of the comparison to other art forms. It's like, when we watch a movie, a lot of movies, even a lot of violent movies, are based on real events. And we also applaud the actor. We applaud Denzel, because when we watch the movie, we don't see Denzel. We see the character. That is, we see Frank Lucas. That's not different in music. We're applauding the artist for giving us a very ultra-realistic sort of description of what's happening, even if that didn't actually happen in their life. And this is the thing with authors and everyone else. A lot of people don't see rap music as an art form. And a lot of people don't see Black artists as able to write in metaphor, or write from imagination, or write from different perspectives. They only expect a literal description. So I think it's important to just see all the ways in which it is art.
Yeah, and the film explores that so, so beautifully. In the construction of the film, JM, you've said that you designed it to feel like a song. And I totally get that. Even Kemba's narration in between different sections almost feels very musical. Can you tell me about that decision?
That was the idea, yeah, that if we were going to make a documentary about the music, then it should feel like the music. And it shouldn't feel like a bunch of people who are outside of hip hop talking about people inside. Like, it should come from the artist's point of view, because we've all seen the news footage, whether it be Young Thug or whoever, on trial. And it's every single other voice. It's the pundits, it's the news commentators, it's the DA, it's the prosecutors, it's even, you know, the defense attorneys or the public defenders who are speaking on behalf of the artist. And it's the artist who's silent and silenced. That just stood out to us as maybe the most obvious person that we wanted to hear from that we hadn't heard from when talking about the issue.
What did it feel like, Kemba, to embody that, to act as a person that was having their lyrics put on trial, to live that through this film?
Even though there were all the cameras there and it was a set, it was still pretty scary to have the prosecutor pointing at me and reading my words all chopped up. When I first heard it, I was like, I don't know if I would make it out of this. It is really like, I don't know. I just really saw how there's really not much that you can do, even having no actual danger in that situation. It felt like if this was real, I don't know if I would make it out of it.
I feel like that would be a really scary thought, even if you know that this isn't a real scenario. But to both of you, do you think that having a film like this out there will support legislation efforts there in the U.S. around banning the use of rap lyrics as trial evidence?
100%. We're very actively talking with people in positions of political power on Capitol Hill and then around the country, because it is a state-to-state legislative battle. It's something that probably won't happen federally because of the atmosphere now, but there is traction being gained in various states. California passed the law, passed a bill protecting rap lyrics. There's a bill that stalled in New York that they're hopeful will come back. And then a handful of other states who have started. And so, yeah, absolutely. Hopefully there's a direct translation to action as a result.
Yeah, we can only hope. That's my answer. We can only hope.
Kemba, what is the takeaway that you want people to get from this documentary? What kind of appreciation do you want them to have for rap lyrics after watching it?
I want people that watch this film to take away the fact that the majority of time this is happening, it is not a famous rapper. It is not somebody that's even making a living off of the art that they create. And so how do we draw the line? Where do we draw the line of calling someone a rapper if they're not, if that's not their profession? And what I take away from that is that the use of the label rapper is an almost surefire sort of way to trigger these prejudices, biases, fears. And since everyone that I know knows somebody that writes, I just want people to understand this is more of an attack on Black and brown people than it is even on rap music.
Thank you both so much. It's a nuanced conversation and a nuanced art form, and I so appreciate you both taking the time to go over it with us.
Thanks for being curious about it and interested in it.
Yeah, thank you, Stephanie. Thanks for watching the film.
J.M. Harper is the director of As We Speak, Rap Music on Trial. Rap artist Kemba stars in the film. Run DMC with Can I Get a Witness?
Time, weather,
Rift from the headlines.
This is Rift from the Headlines, our weekly quiz. Three riffs linked by one story in the news. If you guess the story that links the riffs, you could win a Day 6 tote bag. First, here's a recap. This is last week's clue.
Supermarket, I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for the special offer, guaranteed personality.
That's The Clash with Lost in the Supermarket, Chad Post with Show Me the Receipts, and Shoplifters of the World Unite by The Smiths. Sandy Danilon from Toronto correctly guessed the headline we were looking for. Loblaws faces backlash over receipt scanners at its self-checkouts. Congratulations, Sandy. A Day 6 tote bag will be on its way to you soon. Now here's this week's clue.
Stepping lightly, stepping brightly, with our books in hand. Going to the university to teach and help them understand.
What is the story that connects those riffs? Email us your answer. Put Rift from the Headlines in the subject and send it to day6@cbc.ca. Please include your mailing address because one right answer will be picked at random
The prize is a Day 6 tote bag. And you can listen to The Clue again anytime at cbc.ca/day6.
Time, weather, and
from the headlines.
Ah, yeah!
And that's our show for this week. Day 6 was produced by Lori Allen, McKenna Hadley-Burke, Sarah Melton, and Pedro Sanchez. Our senior producer is Gord Westmacott. I'm Stephanie Skenderis, in for Brent Bambury. Thanks for listening to Day 6.
I know we just met, but would you be willing to lift your shirt up and show me your torso?
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.